Guardian Unlimited.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. And believe me when I tell you, this is the only podcast in the iTuneiverse that's guaranteed to eliminate germs and bad odours, and wash your whites even whiter. Ah, smell that spring freshness. On this week's show, Web 2.0? Ha, it's so last year. Professor John Crowcroft, one of the world's leading computer scientists, will be telling us about the next generation of the internet. We discuss robot rights and robot wrongs, and the impact our mechanized friends will be having on our everyday lives. Would you want a robo-nurse looking after grandma? Plus, we analyse the scrap between Robert Winston and Richard Dawkins. But whose side are you on? Soft, strong, and very, very long, this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Well, there's no denying it. Last week, I really was Billy No-Mate, sitting here alone without any of my regular Science Weekly chums. Things still aren't really perfect, but they are much better. Yes, Nell's still sailing around Monaco and Mauritius and wherever she is, and Alok's still in Italy and he's still having his hair cut. But I'm delighted to say that returning to the pod, badder than ever, it's Guardian technology correspondent Bobby Johnson.
I'm always glad to be back. It feels good to be back in the buckets.
There's a lot of love. Yeah. Yes. Okay. And hello to our producer Ben Green. He's always here because they don't let him leave the building.
It's not a lie. They never let me leave.
Now, Ben's been trying to convince anyone who'll listen this week that he's the god of pod. Why? Well, he reckons he can make a 1972 David Bowie song about the author Jean Genet work as the intro to our item about the future of the internet. Think he can do it? Well, here we go. I don't know, it seems more like God of Pod Delusion to me. And indeed, more of that later. Anyway, our special guest this week is the Marconi Professor of Communication Systems at Cambridge University. He's one of the academics and technologists working on the future of the net. John Crowcroft, welcome to the pod. Perhaps you better explain that awful link.
You lost me on Gene Genie and Jean Genet. Apart from the global experiment in next generation internet work Genie bit, but
yes.
Unfortunately, it's not spelt the same.
Well, that's true. That's true. What is Genie?
The Genie program is basically just a bid at the moment to get $300 million to build some infrastructure. And so, in that sense, it's exactly like the original ARPANET money in 1973. Which is how far back it goes, to get an infrastructure that then a bunch of research projects go loose on and have a kind of playpen to do cool stuff on.
The big question here is where does the net go from here? What are the problems with it at the moment, and how can they be solved? How do you see that? I mean, what are the problems?
There are basically three problems which Genie fails to address completely, which are things you see every day. One is that the net, in its original conception, allows anyone to talk to anyone anytime, from anywhere, at any speed they want. That was a great innovation. It lets you do all kinds of cool stuff. Anyone can source material to places, which is, podcasts, etc., come out of that. Weren't envisaged, but it was an accidental stroke of genius. The problem with that is that then the bad guys can send vast amounts of stuff from anywhere they choose to somebody who's innocently sitting there just trying to do something useful, and then their link to the internet is hosed. Second problem is business relationships, how you actually do business. So one of the big arguments the last few weeks is sort of net neutrality keeps showing up, and basically people like the net to be a level playing field for anyone sending and receiving, whoever they are, however big they are. You don't want to charge Google a lot more money for the same amount of information per unit time to the same number of receivers than some other person who's sending some useless nonsense. And then the third problem is completely different, is nothing to a Genie very much. They've got a little bit of mention of it, but it's basically, it would be really cool if we could, anyway, stood on the planet, get arbitrary speed downloads or uploads and sharing MP3 video, whatever you think of, new stuff, wireless. There are lots of big problems with that, because the way you might do that would involve cooperating between lots of wireless nodes. Imagine all the cell phones in London made a network rather than using the infrastructure cellular telephone providers give you. Then you'd end up with something with potentially a lot more capacity. It might have other problems, and those need fixing, but you could end up with, you know, 10 megabits a second per user. So those seem to me to be like three things which urgently need fixing. The first one, distributed denial of service attacks, might get fixed. The second one, people will do a little playing around the edges, but I just don't see how they're going to get at it. And the wireless one, I really don't think they're going to get anywhere with that.
So we need some kind of overhaul. This might be a slightly kind of uncomfortable question, but is there a sense in which some of the bad guys on the internet, if you like, are part of why it's successful? I mean, you know, for example, pornography is one of the things that drives use on the internet. And is there a sense in which if you stop some things that we regard as bad, then the whole thing sort of collapses?
I think that's not a good example, that particular example, because most of the content on the internet is music and video sharing. The fact is that the community of people that build stuff because they have something to do and are not part of the incumbent big companies are the people who do the innovation often in the internet, and that's often because they just hack stuff up, and hack in the good sense, in double meaning word, but they may also be the bad guys. So you're absolutely right. The basic idea that innovation comes from the top is by diktat. It's kind of what you're suggesting is in line with that, that a bunch of people that just want to do something that might be seen as a little dodgy at first and then turns out to be the right mainstream way of doing things later is cool. Let me give a concrete example. Several major TV, film and music companies are now seriously building peer-to-peer file sharing systems to distribute content. That's because we're actually hitting the ceiling of heat dissipation you can manage in data centers. We actually can't do enough air conditioning in a big data center to go on building them bigger to send more content from them. So the thing to do is to send it out to everyone's home, push the cost to the consumer, if you like, and they redistribute the content. And you have to worry about how you do rights management, payment and stuff. Mm. But you have to worry about that anyway. It doesn't matter how you do the initial distribution. So this just reduces the cost and actually gets rid of a finite limit, you know, that they literally aren't going to be able to have more than 150 real-time IPTV multicast channels for the next 10 years if they do it all from a data center. But if they want a million channels of live stuff, you could do that peer-to-peer right now.
So people doing peer-to-peer file sharing that was, you know, a bit naughty have hit on something that's going to be really useful. Bobby? Exactly.
You just said in 10 years' time if this is going to happen. I mean, what do you see in 10 years' time? Do you have an image of what you think we'll be doing that maybe we're not doing at the moment?
The big thing, I think, is just high-speed wireless. I just think everything will be wireless, and it won't just be wireless access, the way you think about using a cell phone or your laptop instead of a desktop machine, or even a desktop machine as wireless. You get rid of all those wires, but it will be you'll go via everyone else's wireless network. So we'll get higher speed by using everyone, exactly the same as peer-to-peer, builds a content distribution system out of everyone's nodes. Multi-hop wireless builds a high-speed wireless network out of everyone's nodes. And that's interesting because it's got all kinds of social consequences, because to do that, you have to build certain other things, like how do we trust people not to screw up what the content's being distributed or what the network is doing, and how do we just agree that they're going to forward stuff for me because I'll forward stuff for them, maybe, but maybe it won't be a simple mutual exchange thing. It'll be much more complicated. And in fixing those things, some kid out there is going to come up with something very cool, and I have no idea what it will be. It may be some completely different thing. We've already seen things like flash mobs using, you know, cell phones and wireless and SMS to kind of pull a bunch of people together. We've seen all kinds of Bluetooth jacking and other things that people have done. We're going to see things like that, but some of them will be really cool things that will turn into something constructive. You can't predict what they are.
It'll be interesting to look out for that innovation, whatever it turns out to be. John, thanks very much. He'll be here for the rest of the show, so don't you go changing or Googling. I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, a forensic psychologist tells us about the true impact of CSI on juries, plus...
My robots don't kill people.
That thing threw somebody out of a window. Is that registering with you?
A robot cannot harm a human being. The first law of robotics.
Yeah, I know. The three laws. You're in a perfect circle of protection. What if it was given an order to kill?
That's impossible. It's a can opener, for God's sake.
We'll discuss artificial intelligence and all things robotic. That's coming up. But now it's time for a roundup of all the other news from the worlds of science and technology that's been making the headlines over the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
News Jam.
Sorry, that always just makes me laugh. Scientists at the European Southern Observatory have discovered an Earth-like planet orbiting a star 20 light-years away. Its position means it has perfect conditions for liquid water on the surface, and so possibly life. But that's where the similarities with Earth end. Its orbit around the red dwarf Gliese 581 is much tighter than Earth's, so a year on the planet is just 13 days long.
The fertility scientist and TV science personality Robert Winston has attacked fellow scientists for their increasingly outspoken assaults on religion. Lord Winston was particularly critical of the evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, saying his arguments were insulting and patronising to religious people. He said the attacks would result in a loss of trust in science.
Traffic noise in Sheffield is so bad that the city's robins have resorted to singing at night to mark their territories and attract mates. Researchers who studied the birds found that in the city's more tranquil parts, the birds sang during the day as normal, but went in for a nocturnal chorus in places where traffic doubled the noise level.
And finally, Stephen Hawking took his first zero-gravity flight last week, fulfilling a lifetime's ambition. The 65-year-old astrophysicist described his two-hour sojourn in the so-called Vomit Comet as amazing. Unlike many of the other 2,500 commercial passengers who have experienced weightlessness aboard the plane, Professor Hawking did not need a sick bag.
And that was your news jam. Thank you, Ben and Bobby. Who needs Maura Stewart anyway? Now, I'm sure you've all got some thoughts on some of those stories, but first, I think it'd be helpful to kind of flesh out the Winston Dawkins debate a little bit. John, do you think Dawkins is being patronising when he talks about religious people in the way he does?
I think he was pretty careful not to be patronising when he's spoken. There was a TV interview on, I think, BBC World News, and he was pretty cautious in that. If you read the book, which I have, it would be easy to see how somebody would construe it as patronising. Unfortunately, that is his point.
Well, some people argue that it would be patronising to step back from the argument and say, I'm not gonna say those things. I don't want to offend people. What do you think, Bobby?
I think the interesting thing is that really this argument, either side, both sides are pretty much set in their ways. And so if you are a religious, religious person or a scientist with religious views, you're going to see it as patronising because Dawkins continues to make the same point again and again. Whereas on the other side, you agree with Dawkins and you believe him. And I think that's where the arguments come from, is just that nobody's going to change their mind over this. I don't know what the mainstream public feel like. Mm. Which is kind of where Dawkins is trying to make some headway.
Well, I suppose Winston's point is that he might be being counterproductive because, Winston explicitly said that he thinks that this kind of very bombastic approach will kind of reduce people's trust in science and all the rest of it. What do you think, John?
The problem here is that the people that object don't have much trust in science in the first place. I've had conversations with Jesuits who are clearly, people of faith, who have absolutely no problem with what he says. That's just an example of one religious group, but I'm sure one could find other people that are... And they would observe about the religious people that object to this kind of argument, say it's patronising, it's a put-down or whatever. They would say that's a category error, that nothing Dawkins says diminishes faith. He does, however, make comments about the intelligence of people, the distribution intelligence of people that have faith and don't. But those are pretty big assertions. Some of it's based on some fairly loose psychology research that I haven't read in great detail myself, but that's certainly not his expertise, actually. I don't think it's Winston's expertise either. So I think there's some people throwing things around where they're having an argument about a scientific viewpoint without checking their science in the first place.
Always dangerous. I don't know if anyone else saw the images of Stephen Hawking floating around. I thought they were pretty special. He looked like he was having a great time.
as I think anyone would.
Alok's actually done this, hasn't he?
Yeah, Alok's trip on the Vomit Comet. I think he enjoyed it, and I'm sure... I'd love to go up in there. It would be fantastic.
He was very, I don't know, every time he mentioned it, he's sort of obscenely proud of the fact that he didn't manage to throw up. But anyway, I think we should probably leave that one there. thanks very much. If you want to add any of your thoughts on any of these topics, send us an email or post us a comment on the blog. Details coming up at the end of the show. Robot rock. I think the link there is probably a bit easier. I wish you could see Bobby's dancing. It's truly awful. There's something about robots and artificial intelligence that sparks the imagination like nothing else. We're still some way away from staying in bed all day and having a mechanoid take care of our every need and whim. But thankfully, we're also a long way away from living side by side with Blade Runners and Terminators. Or are we? Last week, a panel of experts met in London to discuss how robots might affect people's lives. We asked two of the UK's leading experts what they thought of the Brave New World. First, here's Noel Sharkey, a professor of computer science at the University of Sheffield and a regular contributor to TV's Robot Wars. He told us about the role and prevalence of robots here in the UK and in the rest of the world.
I mean, we don't have a lot of domestic robots in this country yet, unlike some other countries, but they do make our cars and do an awful lot of industrial things. We rely on them in the nuclear industry, for instance. And so robots are kind of behind-the-scenes robots rather than the kinds of domestic robots we hear about, or the toy robots or the fantasy science fiction robots. But if we look at Japan as a model, because in this country we tend to be a little bit conservative with technology, which is a good thing. We wait until other people debug it, try it out, and then we take it on board. And if we look to Japan, you'll find out that they have such things as robot carers. So you might get a sort of toy childminder, or you might get a robot looking after the elderly, or companions. So the Japanese are much more accepting of this than we are. And they will come here. But we've also got concerns, really, about military application of robots and how this, which is increasing dramatically in America, and South Korea are making all sorts of alarming declarations about their future plans, and they already have a border guard with a machine gun, which they commissioned from Samsung.
Noel Sharkey there, no relation to Fergal, but an owner of a truly magnificent beard. The group was highly critical of a recent horizon scanning report from the government about super intelligent robots of the future. It asked, if robots have brains, should they then be given rights? While the robot experts reckon current developments are leaving us plenty to worry about without such wild speculation, here's Professor Alan Winfield of the University of West England.
Certainly I would say that the more pressing ethical question is the use to which we put intelligent machines. I think that military use of intelligent machines, particularly of autonomous machines, is something that does raise serious ethical questions that need to be debated and discussed in society. And we need to decide as a society whether this is something that we would wish our military to use or not. And if not, I'm not expressing a judgment right now. I'm simply saying that this is something that we should not let ourselves, in a sense, sleepwalk into.
For many, many years, there's been this great interest in what would happen when, or if, I suppose most likely if, robots became so sophisticated they could barely be told apart from human beings, everything from Blade Runner to AI. Would you say perhaps that's a less important aspect of the debate than the one you were just talking about now?
Yes, I'd agree with that. I mean, it's great fun to discuss the possibility of highly intelligent robots in the far future. Actually, I think that that's a distraction. I think that there's a much more pressing and urgent issue, which is, the way I would put this is that I'm much more worried about the near term, within the next few years, application of autonomous dumb robots, rather than the long term arrival of possibly super smart robots. So actually it's autonomous robots, particularly by that I mean robots that decide what to do without human intervention, that worry me most. You don't need highly intelligent robots in order for robots to become autonomous. And actually the implications of autonomy, in my view, are much more serious than the implications of intelligence.
Guardian Unlimited's Peter Walker there asking the questions to Professor Alan Winfield. Well, our tech correspondent Bobby Johnson and John Crowcroft from Cambridge University are still in the studio. What do you make of this? Are we, as he says, in danger of sleepwalking into the future?
There's a good point to be made that this isn't really about the rights of robots, but it should be more about the kind of reverse, really, and the impact on human rights that robotics can have. We've done stories recently about, you know, robots in South Korea that guard the DMZ and can shoot people from half a kilometre away. What happens if one of them pops a cap in you? Who do you sue?
Is it?
Yeah, exactly. And to me, I mean, this isn't necessarily it's a step change, but it's not a world away from when your software goes wrong on your computer. You know, it makes a decision, it does something badly. How do you deal with that?
John.
Planes have autopilots. When one of those flies into a building, you have to address precisely that point already. They're autonomous at that point. And I agree completely that that's the point of concern now, that the future of AI rights is still the subject of fine writing by lots of people who are under the fiction bit of science.
Mm. Yeah, it's science fiction rather than current science. Actually, one of the points that the panel raised was that by having sort of military robots out there, you get away from the kind of body bag politics of war, in that when you go to war at the moment, you know, you have a stream of young men coming back in coffins, but you don't have that if your army is made up of robots. It's kind of quite a serious point. It makes it potentially easier for a power that has robots to go to war. This may sound like, you know, major science fiction stuff, but the US has a plan for a third of its ground vehicles to be autonomous robotic vehicles by 2015.
I mean, you could take the analogy on as well that, you know, in war we use creatures, we use, you know, animals and other things that actually, you know, is an animal autonomous? Well, you know, most of the time I'd say the cat that leaves a little present for me in my shoe in the morning, you know, he's probably made a decision there. But, you know, and obviously there is an animal rights movement, so I suppose you can argue that sometime in the future there might be a group who argue for the same thing for autonomous robots. But artificial intelligence, you know, it may have made a few significant developments over the last few years, but it's a very long way.
Yeah. Would you be happy for a robot to look after your gran?
It depends. It depends what the robot did. I mean, you know, in many ways, robots probably already do look after a lot of us. So I think, you know, we're already there in that aspect. I mean, if it was wheeling her to and from, you know, if it was feeding her and stuff like that, and suddenly if it stopped, then something horrible happened, then, you know, we would clearly think about that a bit more carefully.
So, John, yeah, I'll give you the last word.
I think there's a real long-term ethical question that at some point there may be robots around, you know, UAVs that are already being deployed might reach a level of intelligence that is just starting to overlap.
Unmanned aerial vehicles, for anyone who doesn't know, but yeah.
They might just overtake a very naive human, and we wouldn't be arguing that somebody of challenged intelligence or whatever should have their rights taken away. The question is, you know, when that happens, then this will confront us. But I think even for the most extreme case, that's a while off. And I think the other concerns that people raise were much better priorities.
Now, CSI and its multiple spin-offs have been some of the most successful TV shows of the past few years. The franchise has captivated audiences with its sexy, well-dressed forensic geeks and sent students flocking to forensic science courses the world over to emulate their heroes. Surprise, surprise, the real world of forensics is nothing like what you see on the telly. And some forensic experts are worried that it's had a knock-on effect on the criminal justice system. They worry that jurors who have watched the show will have expectations about the science in a case that are impossible to meet. Catherine Ramsland is a forensic psychologist, and she's written a book about the so-called CSI effect and whether it really exists. I spoke with her recently, and she began by telling me the negative impact of the show.
People who watch it think that they now know, you know, what forensic scientists and forensic technicians do. They really don't know, because they're watching a TV show, and what they wear, what they drive, the kinds of devices they use are sometimes even non-existent. They don't solve crimes in an hour. They don't work on one case at a time. Many of the scientists and technicians never even know how a case is resolved. They don't do detective work, things like that. But the real problem is when some of the people who watch the show get into the courtroom, they have expectations such as the DNA is in every case. So why didn't you do a DNA analysis? Fingerprints are always there. Why didn't you do that? And so they begin to have expectations that can't be met because that just isn't true of actual crime scene investigation. That ends up being translated into not guilty by reasonable doubt. The positive things are wonderful. More funding. People understand the scientists better. Juries are actually trying to listen to the scientists instead of dismiss them. They do understand the terminology better than they used to. Many more young people are interested in going into these classes, and there's more of a pro-law enforcement attitude. But more interesting is that scientists and law enforcement are thinking outside their boxes and trying to meet one another and find new ways to apply science to crime scene investigation that has never been done before. And as a result, we're getting innovative new techniques and ideas that's changing law enforcement completely.
What are the sort of common mistakes that happen in the show in terms of the science that they're using that is absolutely
okay.
Bogus?
Okay. One of the ones, my favorite one, is where they use this Doppler something or other laser to listen to a clay pot and find a voice that's in the clay pot because people were having an argument while the guy was throwing in the clay pot. And honestly, it's been used on Stonehenge. It's not altogether totally unheard of. But no crime scene investigators out there with these Doppler lasers listening to clay pots or walls to see if they can find out conversations. So there are times when they're using technologies that are in science fiction or they're on the drawing board. They're not really yet ready for anything. And the CSI writers find out about them and they frame out a story around them. And then people think that's really available, and it's not.
And you said that, you know, the cars they drive and the clothes they wear are not entirely accurate. Is forensic science not as glamorous as that?
Forensic science not only is not that glamorous, it doesn't pay well enough for them to be able to wear those clothes. The people, especially in states like Idaho, where they don't have the resources and whatnot, in New York City is going to be different, obviously, than, you know, some small place. But they cannot wear clothes like that because they're impractical. You can't wear tight jeans and low-cut blouses and things. You just can't do that. You have to wear bio suits and, loose-fitting clothing so you can do your work. You're not worried about a fashion show. You're worried about getting the stuff done right.
That was Catherine Ramsland. Her book, Forensic Science of CSI, is out now. Thank you, as ever, for all your comments and emails, good, bad, or indifferent. We do take on board all of your feedback. Now, let's start with the positive. Jo, who's a 17-year-old mathematician studying for her A-levels, or, well, who knows, maybe she's a child prodigy and she's actually finishing off her PhD. Anyway, she says...
Great show, guys. It's a welcome relief from revision and past papers, but still educationally enough for me to convince myself that I'm not slacking. Keep up the good work.
And Darwin D told us...
Thank you for the really interesting interview with Susan Blackmore. She's absolutely one of the most influential thinkers in my worldview. Also, it's so nice to hear the term zombie used in a serious scientific discussion. And is there anything more serious than consciousness?
But not everyone's so happy. Kiernan writes...
The only interesting thing about human consciousness is how it came about. If you accept evolution, then human consciousness must have evolved. How did it come about and when did it come about? What's the environment where we evolved that made us develop human consciousness? Whether or not we have free will is not science, it's religion.
Well, HRH Pod says our debate on consciousness...
seems sadly lacking in conscious and sense.
Well, why don't you all make up your own mind? If you missed last week's programme with Susan Blackmore, head to guardian.co.uk/science/podcast. And for all of you who enjoyed our discussion on consciousness, there may be more where that came from, so watch this space. Okay, people, that's your lot for this week, I'm afraid. If you want to get in touch, email us at science@guardian.co.uk, head to the blog, or investigate myspace.com/guardianscience. And if you're new to Science Weekly, you'll find a full archive of our shows at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. Have a listen, and if you feel we're worthy, why not register your vote for us at the Webby Awards Listener's Choice category? All that remains for me is to say a huge thank you to everyone in the pod, Bobby Johnson, and our special guest, Professor John Crowcroft. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. Alok's back in the hot seat next week, but for now, I've been James Randerson, and you've been a great audience. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.